someone showed me a church that is doing a series on Nehemiah. I think they're starting today, and they showed me their graphics for the series that this church is doing, this other church is doing on Nehemiah. And it was tasteful, it was archaeological, there was buildings, it was kind of appropriate to the age and the setting and the ancient history that we're dealing with in the book of Nehemiah. We've gone for Eurotrash. So when Laura says we're different, we kind of are different. But I like the idea of future builders, because for many people, the future is something that you just drift into. The future is something that just happens to you. The future is something that you feel that you've got no control over. Some of you, you look at the news, you look at what's happening in our culture, in our country, in our society, and you throw your hands in the air and you think, well, what can be done? It's out of my hands. The future is coming towards us. And I don't know if it's a future that's going to be good. We look at what's happening with Brexit, with political division, with the rise of the right. We look at our world, we look at the ecological catastrophe that seems to be impending. We feel like the future is something which is scary. The future is something which is threatening. The future is something that we don't feel that great about. If you are less than 20 years old, your future, your understanding of the world is pretty much shaped by terror and tragedy, 9/11, Twin Towers. The world looks like it's going to hell in a handbasket. And some of us, for the future that we have for our own lives, you think about where your life is heading. It's not an easy time when you're looking at exams, those of you that are studying here. And you think, where's my life going? Some of you, you're going to be graduating soon. Others of you, you're well into the world of work. And you look and you see it stretching out in front of you. And you think, what kind of a future do I have? Do I just become a wage slave, working for the man, living for the weekend? What about relationships? You look at the relationship that your mother and your father had. And you think, I don't want that to be my future. You don't have the great models around you. You just have dysfunction that has been a kind of factor in your past and the people that you see around you. And you think, is that my future? And for so many people, the future is something that happens to us, and the future is something which is threatening. And it causes a certain degree of fear, worry, anxiety. And in our culture today, anxiety, depression is up to record levels. Because people look in the future and they find it a difficult prospect to handle. But what we're going to talk about in this series, 4 weeks on the book of Nehemiah, we're talking about people that are future builders. We here believe that we as a community are called to be future builders. In other words, not just people that drift into the future, but people that construct the future. People that have a vision for the future and actually make it work. And so whether you have a vision for yourself, whether you have a vision for the job that you're doing, whether you have a vision for the city, the country, the world, we're going to talk about the keys to unlocking that vision, to making that future actually happen. Because when you follow Jesus, and if you're not a follower of Jesus here tonight, you just need to know this. When you follow Jesus, the whole deal is you get to build the future with God. You get to collaborate with what the Holy Spirit is doing in our world. And it's an amazing thing. The book of Nehemiah is an incredible book because it's not, you think a book called Nehemiah, it's named after the guy, you think it's going to be one of these great big men who's just an unusual, extraordinary, chosen one who does great things all on their own. Actually, that's not quite what it was. Nehemiah was someone that lived as an exile in the Persian Empire. He was a Jew carried off and born and raised in Persia. About the 5th century, so that's around about 2,500 years ago. And yet when we go into his story, we find that he's only one part of it, and that Nehemiah is this extraordinary book, because it is about how everyone gets to play a part. And what happens with Nehemiah and with the people in Nehemiah, the leaders that come round, the families that band together, a community that pulls in the same direction, they build a future that did not exist, a future that few thought could ever happen. The basic story is that Jerusalem has been sacked, it has been overrun, it has been destroyed, burnt with fire. And for 150 years, it has been a place of disrepute, shame, and despair. The temple has been rebuilt up to a fashion, but the walls are broken down, which means the city has no identity and it has no hope. And for 150 years, these broken down walls represent a broken down people. And yet, within the space of 52 days, less than 2 months, Nehemiah and the people that gather around together around this one common vision, they build a brand new future. They put the walls back up. They establish the nation of Israel. They put it back on its feet. And it's an incredible, incredible story. And what I love about Nehemiah is that Nehemiah wasn't one of these people that was the chosen one. He wasn't royalty. He wasn't the son of someone special that you've heard of. He wasn't in a royal line. He didn't get a vision from God. He didn't have a dream of the future. But he was someone that got vision. And sometimes we think that vision is about special people that see something amazing. You know, an angel speaks to them, or somehow God gives them a dream one night and they realize that they're chosen and they see this thing. But vision's not really like that at all. And so I'm going to give you, as we start this series off, I'm going to give you the four phases of vision, how it works, how you can get vision. Now, you can get a vision for your life. You can get a vision for your job. You can get a vision for your friends. You can get a vision even for your relationship. But I want to talk about that in the general terms, but also how we as a community are gripped with a vision that is bigger than all of us put together. A vision for our city, to build the city up. Nehemiah and these Jews back in the 5th century, they did that thing. They changed their city forever. And we have the ability and the opportunity to do the same thing. Before I get into the mechanics of the book, I just want to just highlight to you what I feel is going to be a thread that's going to run through these next 4 weeks. I'm doing this, and then next week Sam comes up. The week after that, Kate takes up the baton, and then Matt Price brings it all home. But the thread that's going to run through is this. In order to change the world, in order to build the future, the one thing more than any other thing that Nehemiah teaches us is that you have to pray as if it all depends on God. Everyone say, pray as if it all depends on God. Turn to the person next to you. Pray as if it all depends on God. In the book of Nehemiah, it's this incredible thing. It's this social transformation. It's the rebuilding of a city. And yet it isn't just a book of social activism. It is a book of prayer. There are 14 prayers recorded by Nehemiah. Nehemiah prays more than anybody you've ever heard or ever come across. He prays constantly. He prays formally. He prays privately. He prays long. He prays short. He prays with others. He prays on his own. It's prayer, prayer, prayer. You pray as if it all depends on God, because the kind of vision that we have to change our world, we need and can only do it with God's help. It all depends on God. But at the same time, you work as if it all depends on you. Say it. Work as if it all depends on you. So you've got this tension. On the one hand, you pray as if it all depends on God, but at the same time, you work as if it all depends on you. Some Christians, they have a mentality that says, we just got to work, we just got to get our heads down. We've got to do good things. We've got to affect our society. And that's great. But you'll never do what you want to do if it's just about you working hard. And some people, they say, well, we've got to pray. We've got to pray. We've got to worship. We've got to pray because God will do it. Actually, if that is the way that you operate, you will never see God move in the way that you want to move, because there's a marriage between praying as if it all depends on God and working as if it all depends on you. And that's what we see in the book of Nehemiah. So we're going to start off with chapter 1, and it says this. The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah. In the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile, and also about Jerusalem. They said to me, those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burnt with fire. The first phase in this process is looking at the world and seeing what is. Seeing the world the way that it is. You've got the world as it is. That's the first phase. And basically what it means is you're hearing the heart cry of the world around you. So hearing that heart cry from people, hearing the cry of the city is what is the first stage in the process of getting a vision. Visions don't just fall out of the sky. Visions don't just strike like a lightning bolt. Vision comes from people who first of all hear. They see the things as they are. Hear what is. You see what is going on. It's possible to live in a bubble. Now, the incredible thing about this story, as Nehemiah talks about hearing from his brother Hanani, who'd come from Judah to tell the story of how the Jewish people are getting on in their own city of Jerusalem. The incredible thing is, Nehemiah knows all this. Nehemiah, this is not news to Nehemiah. It's not news to Nehemiah that there's no war. It's not news to Nehemiah that the gates are broken down. But there's something about him hearing that impacts him in a way. So let's just take a little step back and put Nehemiah into his historical and geographical context. If we get our map onto the screen, so here's our world. We just zoom in on that Mediterranean basin, the Near East, the Far East. So you've got the city of Jerusalem there. It's the Jewish capital. And it's the place that God has always said to his people, this is my city. It's the city of David. This is where I will be. This is where the temple will be. This is where my presence will be. And Jews would go to Jerusalem four times a year for great festivals. It was their weekend away. And they would rejoice. They would come from all over the nation because Jerusalem wasn't just a city. It was a symbol of the whole nation. It was their identity. It was where they came together and where they met with God. But in the year 586, Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king of Babylon, now Babylon was this great superpower. He basically attacked Jerusalem and Judah three times. And each time he came, he took people away. And he kept chipping away with them. The first wave, second wave, third wave, until on the third wave, he totally destroys the city. He breaks the walls down. He burns the temple. He carries people off. So if you've heard of Daniel, the book of Daniel, Daniel and the lion's den, Meshach, Shadrach, Abednego, they were guys that were carried off in the first wave of war with this Babylonian superpower. But pretty much by the third wave, everyone has been taken. So they're taken literally from Jerusalem up to the north and then back down to the south into Babylon, which is the center of the Babylonian empire, Hanging Gardens of Babylon, one of the seven wonders of the world. Now, Daniel is there, he rises to prominence, and just less than 50 years later, that Babylonian superpower that seems so imposing, that gathered so much of the world's landmass, they're overtaken, they're conquered by this new superpower, the greatest power that the world has ever seen. This is the Persian Empire. And so in around about 540, Cyrus the Great, he comes, he trashes Babylon, takes over all their lands, as all of his lands, and makes this great big super empire. And he is more disposed to the Jews. And so after a while, he allows them to start to go home and repopulate Jerusalem, which is exactly in line with what God prophesied. God said, you're going to be in captivity for 70 years. 70 years later, Daniel, others, they began to see God moving. And so these guys get moved back to Jerusalem. And they start to build things back up again. They try to create the temple, and they get a kind of temple. It's not as good as it used to be, but they're never able to get the walls up. And by the time we get to Nehemiah, we're around about 444 BC. So the capital, the palace of the Persian Empire, is in Susa. It's this incredible ornate thing. It's made with gold and ivory and silver and cedar wood. It's just the most incredible. We're talking Game of Thrones kind of stuff. And this Artaxerxes is now the king. So he's like your Kim Jong-un. He is the dictator, the despot. He has power, utter power. He is revered and worshipped as a god. And while the Jews in Jerusalem start building the wall up, Artaxerxes, with his total, absolute power, tells them, you're not allowed to build the wall up. He issues a decree. He issues a decree because the neighboring people around Jerusalem are threatened by the idea of Jerusalem becoming a city again. and Israel becoming a people again. And so they petition the king. And Artaxerxes, poof, this is it, I have spoken. And so it's now been just this awful time where the city is broken, Artaxerxes has spoken, and people are in dismay and disarray. Now, Nehemiah, he's in Susa. He was actually a court official. He knows all this. It's been like this since he was born. The walls of the city have been broken down for nearly 150 years. Long, long, long before Nehemiah was born, or his father was born, or his grandfather was born, those walls were down. And yet there's something about hearing this message, hearing the message that his brothers give him, that he somehow is affected in a way that it's never affected him before. And the first part of vision is you have to hear the city. You have to hear the culture. You have to hear people. Sometimes you have to hear yourself. But it's about being aware. Do you know that as Christians, it's possible for us to live in a big spiritual bubble, to worship God, to come to church, to meet in home groups, to have wonderful lives and get on really well and be faithful and kind to one another. But we're in a bubble and we don't realize what's going on in the outside world. We're not listening. We're not aware. We're not hearing. And if you don't hear, you'll never have a vision. There's something about hearing it from the horse's mouth and being able to really listen to what the heart cry is that starts you on the road to vision. When I was at university in the late 1800s, I was doing engineering here in Bristol, and I was part of the Christian Union. And you know, it was a kind of a Christian bubble. We were all good people. We were all really super nice. And we used to meet. In those days, we met in the Student Union building. We met on a Saturday night. And what would happen on a Saturday night is you'd go to the Student Union building, you'd get into a lift, you'd press the button for the top floor. You'd go up in the lift, you'd go to the Avon Gorge room. We'd have a wonderful time. We would encourage one another, read the Bible, worship, pray, and slap each other on the back. Then you get into the lift, you press the button for the ground floor, you get out of the lift, you go home about your life. You're in a bubble. One Saturday, I got in the lift with a bunch of my friends. They pressed the button for the bottom floor. And I thought, hang on a minute. I pressed the button for the second floor. Let's just get out and let's see what's happening in this student union. I went into one of the bars and I sat and I listened. And as I listened, I began to hear. I began to hear people's heart cry. I started to make it a bit of my practice that every Saturday, instead of going straight out from the bubble into my good life, I would go into the pubs and I would sometimes spill out with them at the end, and I would watch people and I would talk to people, seeing people throwing up on the roadside, hearing people telling their stories of heartache, misery, hearing the stories of brokenness and anxiety about the future. As I started to hear it, something started to happen in me. Because the next thing that happens is that you begin to respond. And so it goes on. Nehemiah says, when I heard these things, I sat down and I wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. This next phase is basically saying that once we've had this situation where we see things as they are, we now move into a time where we see that it shouldn't be like this. And this is a time of hurting. It's a time where you go from hearing to having your heart broken. And there's something about Nehemiah. He hears what's happening and it gets him. It affects him. He opens himself up. And he goes to God, and instead of God saying, don't worry, I'll take care of you, you're fine, continue your quiet time, continue your prayer life. Instead of that, for 4 months, we find it's 4 months as we read later into the book. For 4 months, he's weeping, he's mourning, he's fasting, he's crying, he's heartbroken, and he's heartbroken before God. As if God is saying, I feel it too. I'm heartbroken, and I want you to share my pain. That's the thing about vision. It doesn't come because you see a future that you want to happen. It comes because you absolutely can't stand the future, the present that you have. You're totally moved because you see the way that things are and you say, it shouldn't be like this. It breaks your heart. Until you've had your heart broken, you will never change the future. Until it becomes that personal, you'll never make a difference. You will know, if you've been around, you've heard us talking about Metro. We've been going for around about 3.5 years now. But maybe a couple of years before then, when we were thinking about it, we were basically getting a vision. Now, the Woodlands group of churches has got a grand vision, continually reproducing the life of Jesus. Started 35 years ago, 6 people in the back room. Now it's over 2,000 adults, 700 children. But that vision, we're a part of. But for me, a couple of years before we started Metro, I was doing an Alpha course, which is a really fantastic course to be on. If you've got questions about faith, do Alpha. We got one starting in just a couple of weeks. So I'm in the group, and I'm with these guys, and it's going pretty good. We get to about week 4, week 5, and these guys are really opening up, and they're starting to make spiritual progress. And I say to these two guys, they're in their 20s, I said, hey, guys, you should come to church. Come to Woodlands. Now, I was in Woodlands. I liked being in Woodlands as one of the leaders. I liked my role in Woodlands because I didn't have to lead anything directly, like with people and stuff. I could just preach and talk and be on a stage, and then I could be in other churches. I like going away. I like kind of being in, you know, a church, but I like leaving it because I find church a bit boring. And so I like going to other, I didn't say that. I like going to other churches and speaking and just, you know, so I had the perfect job. I was kind of like Maverick in chief in Woodlands. So I could do whatever I want and it was fine. The church will just happen without me. I certainly don't want to be involved with leading a church. You know, I just don't care. And so I'm in with these guys. They're 20-somethings. And I say, come to Woodlands, come to the 7 p.m. service. Come and meet me. I'll meet up with you. And so I waited. They said, yeah, we'd love to come. We're definitely up for it. We're really feeling this thing. Sunday night, I look out for them. They're not there. Next Wednesday, it's Alpha. I said, hey, guys, you said you were going to come to church. They said, we did. I said, I didn't see you. They said, it was too full. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, we came in and we came into that nice foyer. And we looked and every seat was taken. There were people sat right to the back. There was even a little bit of a crowd gathering in the foyer. And we took one look at that and we just said to each other, there's no room for us. And when I heard that, something inside me broke. I began to mourn and I began to weep and I began to be sorrowful. And I was sorrowful before God. I'd been happy before. I've been super happy. In fact, when the church is full, I'm super happy. I love the full church. But from that evening onwards, it changed me forever. And ever since then, I've hated full churches because it means that you don't have room for my friends to come in, people who are finding God for themselves. And I just said, it shouldn't be like this. I can't stand it. This irks me. This angers me. This really messes with my head. And that's the second phase of vision. You hear and you see the way that the world is. You see the way that things are. Before we started Metro, we listened to our community. We got a hold of the stats. We found out the demographics of our city. We were shocked when we found that only 1% of students, if that, have any connection, meaningful connection with church. We were devastated when we found out that of all the 20s in Bristol, only 1.5% of them have any connection with church. We were aware that the church was losing, that people were being turned away and turned off and tuned out. And it began to break our hearts. It began to mess with our heads. And we just got to the point where we think it shouldn't be like this. Mourning. And then there's the next phase. Once you've been through that, so Nehemiah says this, he prays. Then I said, Lord, the God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and keep his commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's family, have committed against you. We've acted very wickedly towards you. We've not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws you gave your servant Moses. Remember the instruction you gave your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and obey my commands, then even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. They are your servants and your people, whom you redeemed by your great strength and your mighty hand. So this next phase of vision, you go from seeing what is, you feel it shouldn't be. Now you look at what could be. It's George Bernard Shaw who said, "Some look at the way the world is and ask why. I dream about the way that the world could be and ask why not." And that dreaming phase, it's the third phase. You begin to see it could be like this. You spend time in God's presence, and that's why Nehemiah, he's working as if it all depends on him, but he's praying as if it all depends on God, and he's in God's presence, and he begins to pray. And when he prays, he says, "You're the awesome God. You're the amazing God. You're the all-powerful. You're the all-consuming fire. You are the one that has no limitation. You're boundless. You're peerless. You can do anything." And he says, you said, and it's true, you said that if we sinned and if we were unfaithful to you and to our covenant relationship with you, then you'd spread us to the four corners of the earth. But you also said that if we confess and if we ask for your forgiveness, then you will gather us up and you'll put us in the place that you've called over your name. And that's Jerusalem. And he's now dreaming of what could be, because when you follow God, you have limitless possibility. Turn to the person next to you and say, "Limitless possibility." That's the fun thing about being a follower of Jesus. And again, if you're not following Jesus, if you're a little bit on the outside, then this stuff is going to be a little bit less relevant, because it's the dreaming about what God can do which changes how I view the possibility of a new future. That dreaming that says God is capable, God is able to do this. The dream that says, "God, this is your problem, this is your people, this is your issue, do something. And I know that you can do it." When I think about our city, Bristol, when I look at Bristol, you know, the cocaine capital of Europe, one of the greatest homeless populations in the whole country, second only to London. When I look at the depths of inequality, the things that Marvin was saying last week about how it's the seventh worst place in Britain to be black. When I think about the women caught in the sex trade, when I think about the trafficking that goes on of human beings, when I think about the fact that in our universities, we have a greater suicide rate than anywhere else in the nation. And it breaks my heart, and I think it shouldn't be like this. And when I think about the church, which is so pathetic, dwindling, without fresh ideas and fresh hope, I can despair until I turn to face God and I begin to dream. When we talked about doing Metro, we began to dream. A few of us, we got together, we began to dream. What could this be like? What could God do? Arthur O'Shaughnessy, the poet, he says, "We are the dreamers of dreams. We are the movers and shakers of the world forever, it seems. One man with a dream at pleasure shall go forth and conquer a crown. Three with a new song's measure will trample a kingdom down." In other words, when you start to dream and when you start to see what God can do, it changes the way that you react. It changes the way that you think. And we began to get this vision that we could do something. We could be part of what God is doing in Bristol. Not just us, but with all the churches in Bristol. And when we dream big. We dream of Bristol being a city of hope, a city of refuge. We dream of people coming to find faith in Bristol. That Bristol isn't the place where statistically, as it is now, Bristol is a place that 20-year-olds come to lose their faith. Bristol is a place where teenagers come to lose their faith. Instead of that, we see Bristol being a place where you find faith, where God is here, where the supernatural is commonplace. Amen? Where we are seeing God move and where we are seeing people finding hope and community, that there's equality, that there is justice, that there is mercy. And we dream, we dream, we dream. But if it's just a dream, nothing will ever happen. You can dream about stuff, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're ever going to do anything about it. And some people, they just stop at prayer. Oh God, do this. You can do this. But nothing really ever changes because you've got to get to the next final stage. This is what Nehemiah says. He says, Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man. And then what he says makes Nehemiah chapter 1 the greatest opening chapter of any book in the Bible, in my opinion. I mean, it just kills. Because you've gone through this whole story of Nehemiah. You know, he's there. He's in Susa. The gates have been broken. He gets the report. He's sad. He cries. He fasts before God. He prays this great big prayer because he prays as if it all depends on God. And then he does this prayer and he says, give me favor in the presence of this man. And you think, which man? Where are you going with this? And then the literal last sentence of the whole chapter, boom, mic drop. He says, I was cupbearer to the king. You go, whoa, I don't know what a cupbearer does. Is it like a fancy waiter? Cupbearer. Okay, yeah, traditionally you drink the wine before it goes to the king, the most powerful man who has ever lived in all of history. Yeah, you're the one that's trusted to make sure that nothing happens to him. But being the cupbearer to the king isn't just any kind of functional position. It means that you are the keeper of the royal signet. You are the administrator of the royal accounts. You are the confidant of the most powerful man in history. You have his ear, you get to advise. And when he's not there, you are second in command in the whole of the empire. You have unfathomable, incredible opportunities. And you have this incredible place. And I think to myself, Nehemiah, you're like second in control of the biggest empire that the world has ever seen up to this point. Why did you not lead with that? The words of Nehemiah, cupbearer to the king Artaxerxes, keeper of the royal signet, administrator of the royal accounts, confidant to the most powerful. No, why did you not lead with that? And I'll tell you why. And this is kind of his secret. He doesn't see his job as his identity. This is who I am, and this is what is everything about me. Instead, he sees his job as his opportunity. He's saying, yeah, this is where it fits into vision, because I'm crying out to God, I'm dreaming, but now I'm bringing in my opportunity. And so this is the final part of vision. You see what is, you feel it shouldn't be like this, you get a dream of how it could be, and then you think it should be. It should be, it should change, it should be different. And this is the driving phase, when you get such an energy, such a power, you're driven with such a passion. Because not only do you think, well, it could happen, you think it absolutely must happen. And what happens is a kind of equation that takes place when you realize, actually, I have an opportunity. I'm cupbearer to the king. Yeah. The same king that specifically issued a royal decree that those walls would never go back up again in his time, under his watch. But sure, I can go in front of him. Yeah, the king that could have me ripped apart, thrown to the dogs, crucified, impaled on a spike. The king who has absolute power. I'm just a really, really, really well-paid slave. But I have that opportunity. And if I can do something, I must do something. And if I should do something, then this is something that can happen. If it can happen, it should happen. And vision is different from dream, because dream, we can all have a dream. You have a dream that you're going to marry Prince What is he? Monty? Minty? Archie? I don't know. That's a pretty long-term dream. Anyone can have a dream. That, I don't know where that came from. I was just thinking, all the princes are already married, aren't they? Okay. Have to go down a generation. Play the long game. Anyone can have a dream. But the change happens when you say, this is not just something that could happen. This is something that absolutely, positively should happen. And if I can make it happen, if I have an opportunity, I absolutely have to take this on board. That's why we're doing Metro. I didn't want this. I'd never asked for this. I never wanted to lead a church. I was thinking that people that lead churches are just... I won't say it because it's not a nice thing. I didn't think it was that great. And I certainly didn't think I've got the skill set for it. And I don't think I've got the skill set for it. But I just thought, we have to do something. We can't have churches that are turning people away that want to know more about Jesus. We've got to create space. We can't see the church just vanish into ever-decreasing circles. We've got to make something. We've got to grab a hold of God. I have a vision. We see something that could be totally different. And in 52 days, the Israelites, with this vision, together, and we're going to see how this happened next week. It's so exciting. Come back. It's so amazing. They all get name-checked. It's just as incredible. Chapter 2, chapter 3. Amazing, amazing chapters. But they did something that was remarkable, unparalleled, unprecedented, unheard of. For 150 years, those walls are down. They brought them up. And you'll hear about how this was an impossible construction to bring about. And yet the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, the perfume guy, the priest, his dog, literally everyone bandies around and they do something. And we can do something in our city. We can rebuild what is broken in our city. We can do the work of God in our city. We can see kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. In Bristol as it is in heaven. In your workplace as it is in heaven. In your hall, in your faculty as it is in heaven. In your flat as it is in heaven. With your circle of friends as it is in heaven. We can all be part of this. We all get to play. We can see God do great things. God wants to give us vision. So this is the big idea that we have for this week. Big idea is this. Vision is formed as we hear, hurt, dream, and drive. By praying as if it all depends on God and working as if it all depends on us, we build a future that should be. So next week, we take this up. This is setting the scene. But I just want to go into a time of prayer, and I want to invite you just to, in a sense, affirm yourself as a dreamer. Someone with a dream at pleasure can go and conquer a crown. Will you be that person? Will you be that person that sees honestly the way that the world is, that allows it to grieve you? We spend time in God's presence, and we will take his broken heart. And we begin to pray and cry out, and we see what God can do. Because he's powerful. He's not forgotten about you, your friends, your family, your street. He's not forgotten about Nailsy. He's not forgotten about Portishead. He's not forgotten about Bedminster. He's not forgotten about Stoke Gifford. He cares for all of it, and he's well powerful, well able. But he's looking for people who say, we absolutely have to do this. We have an opportunity. I have an opportunity to bring Jesus to my friends. I have an opportunity to change my circumstances. So let's pray. I just want you to close your eyes, and I just want you to give a bit of space. Get the band up. And I just want you to make your quiet response to God. Just take 10 seconds. I want you to say, God, what does your heart break for? What do you want my heart to break for? How can I hear the heart cry? Vision isn't for overachievers, the special chosen ones. Vision is for people that just see things as they are. Can't stand it, and begin to see what God can do. So, Father, I pray that you would unite us in vision. I pray you'd give us vision for our own lives. But I pray that we will be caught up in something bigger than ourselves, a vision to transform a city, a vision to bring the kingdom of God to Bristol in a way that it's not ever seen before. Father, would you move in us? Would you open our ears, break our hearts? Would you allow us to dream and drive us forward with a should? It should be. Let us see what you see. In Jesus' name.